High Libertine, Chapter 9. Miss Callow was flattered. Miss Callow had been flattered every day for a week now. What with the new obedience she got from the girls, the respectful astonishment granted to her by Sir Gregory, and most of all, the daily presence of the grave young godling from Featherfront. Of the latter flattery, Lance was of course aware, since he had planned it. She familiarized him with the others, gushing out her impressions with all the irresistibility of the newly open-hearted.
"They peep through the curtains when you come, the little dears. Barbie jumps up and down and says, 'He's walking, he's walking,' or 'He's riding.' And Bella pushes her away from the window and she cries, 'Ha, ha!' Oh, the dears! Bella asked her father if, when he was knighted, he was given a suit of armour. She wanted him to lend you the suit of armour as a sort of game, so she could see you come riding up in the sunlight. The silly thing, imagine, armour in these times, and borrowed from a man his size!" She looked up at him, and showed her teeth and the edges of her eyes, neither of which were quite white. Her incisors looked like molars.
"And since we've been walking every day, they watch me and watch me, wondering what I do, what I say, that makes you notice me. They obey so nicely, and pay attention every minute. And then there's dear poor Sir Gregory. I dare say he's never noticed me in his life before, except as an item governess in his accounts, and at his table. Since our little talks began, I can never so much as pass him in the hall, but he stops and turns and watches me, as much as to say, 'How do you do it, Callow? There's a pipit.'"
Lance gravely inspected the flight of a small brown bird, which flew like, and looked like, most other small brown birds that his city eyes had ever encountered. He made an interested sound, however. Even as alchemy had been Meadows' bait, natural philosophy had been hers. Natural philosophy in Hepzibah Callow's lexicon was very nearly what would one day be called biology. All living things were within its compass. The philosophy part of it was an untiring effort to link all things into one great shapely analogy. As the flowers do, so do the bees. As the bees, cattle, camels, and cormorants. As these do, so should man. It was a shockingly long time before Lance saw the pitfall in this, having little interest in the specifics to begin with. It was only surprising that he caught up with the generalities when he did.
"Dragonfly,"
she would croon, holding the four-winged horror 4 inches from his mouth, while, since he would not, his chin retreated and retreated until he was only Nick, with a white, frightened gash of a mouth, from nostrils to collarbone. He was morally certain that the monster would escape and zip-zip sew up his lips.
"You see this little probe? It's a daddy dragonfly. They mate on the wing, swoop-swoopin' and a-climbin',"
she would beam. "Or a swarm of bees big enough to pull down a grape arbor.
The queen's in there, callin' and callin', and oh, they all want her."
He learned about vixen and she-bears, and the latter's proclivity for licking their shapeless young into final form with their strong, wet, warm tongues, and heard the words used strongly, wetly, warmly, by a tongue that shot out and oozed back like a hermit crab. He learned about cloacae, and meati, and fundus, and sphygnum, and a great many other answers to questions he wouldn't dream of phrasing. It was all scholarly and impersonal. She made no direct analogies. She discussed all things unblushingly, because she never touched upon a single thing upon which contemporary usage demanded a blush. The analogies were there, however, pervasively, atmospherically there. There were times when, in spite of himself, Lance was carried away by the ubiquity of her intimations, and saw flashes of her world, through which crawled, climbed, flew, scurried, struggled, and strove, organ paired with organ. His mien was calm and his discourse polite, but underneath he felt a rising tide of horror as he learned and learned and learned things. "My God," he would cry inwardly, "date palms too?" He went to Boroughbridge about it. "I cannot catch up with her," he said ruefully. "The faster I run, the faster she goes. But she is behind me. Surely this isn't what you had in mind."
"Seize the initiative, boy. Push a little sooner, a little harder than she bargains for."
"Push a capful of wind over a precipice?" Lance grumbled. "You have not seen her."
"No."
So he brought her. It meant only a few minutes' longer walk. Time enough to apologize for the primitive state of the residence of a scholar and a scientist. Mindful of the old man's counsel, he put an arm around her shoulder as he explained. As soon as he had finished his statement, she made this speech.
"I have never done this before. However, if you feel as I do, that there are currents in nature that should not be denied, and if you will be ordinarily civil to me in my ignorance, I should be glad to learn the mortal version of the dragonfly's coupled flight."
That is what she said, coupled flight. Lance took his arm off her shoulder and walked, holding it slightly away from his side, not trusting its effect on people it touched. Meadows broke out of the house as they came into view, turned right about, and broke in again. Lance led Miss Callow to the laboratory door, and they entered, just in time to see Meadows' left heel flip out of sight. Miss Callow marched to the center of the tall, cluttered room, and moved her two tense hands together and upward, as if they were full of sand which she was letting trickle out from between quivering fingers.
"Oh, science," she intoned. "Science!"
And then turned to Lance, burying her front fangs in a worshipful smile. Over her shoulder, Lance saw Meadows' head appear in the doorway, its hollow eyes fixed on Miss Callow's three-quarter rear profile. "Come," said Lance, and went toward the doorway. By the time they reached it, Meadows was disappearing out the front. He seated her on the settle before the fireplace and excused himself, and went round through the kitchen to the cupboard stair. At its foot he paused, his nostrils a-quiver. The air was spoonable thick with the combined odours of rotten celery and rancid butter. He looked about and saw the mute girl, Johnson, perched on a high stool by a window, which she had closed as far as possible on her arm, leaving a bandaged portion outside in the fresh air. He called a question to her, but she merely turned dumb, brute eyes to him and turned away. He shrugged and mounted. He found Boroughbridge lying in bed next to the wall, with his eyes fixed on the gimlet hole.
"I say," said the barrister, "these are barefaced times. Enough so that the Monthly Review hints it's sinful that our poor mad George the Third should be left unshaven. Yet look at yon paramour of yours, Lanky. Methinks if a body must wear a moustache, it ought to be kept trimmed."
"Ah, yes, she is a beauty," said Lance, and explained what had happened for a mere touch upon the shoulder.
"Jolly good thing you didn't touch her knee," said the old man in high amusement. "She'd bring you a litter of 12.
With some heat, Lance snapped,
"I'd count myself fortunate could I lie abed and be a sage, while you cast your innocence at yon hairy limbo."
"Advice," said Boroughbridge, levelling his eyebrows, "is worth generally what you pay for it. I was an heir to give it to you gratis, Lanky. You have devalued it. There is also a saying, I think, Portuguese, to the end that one should never give advice, lest one be blamed for the consequences to fools who follow it."
"Mr. Boroughbridge," said Lance piteously, "what am I going to do?"
The old man applied his eye to the gimlet hole again, and turned away, shaking his head. Then he was still for a while, and finally his eyes snapped open.
"There's a way out, if only you can think of it," finished Lance Rahim.
Unsmiling, but with his eyes a-twinkle, Barrowbridge said,
"Thank you, lad. Now do escort the lady home, and we'll apply ourselves to the matter."
"Very well. I know you will, sir, and thank you. What have you done to Johnson? She smells like an exhumation."
"Not I. 'Twas your associate there. She burnt herself on a faggot in the stove, and he's treating it. He has a theory, I think, that evil has a magnetism for evil. He's applied yon serpent spit to her to draw out the poison."
"Heaven preserve her!"
Lance bolted down the stairs and ran to the servant. He knocked open the casement and drew her away from it. The odor from the dressing fairly knocked him down. He held a handkerchief to his mouth and with his free hand tore off the dressing. The forearm was flayed and shiny, in a patch 6 inches long, and covered with a yellowy-green tallow substance, which was obviously the author of the stench. He plunged the arm into a deep firkin of wash-water, where at least it was sealed off from the air, and took 2 great handfuls of soft soap, working under the water, scrubbed away the mendicant, while the mute made screaming faces. When he drew the arm out, it still smelled worse than a living thing should, but at least one white stay within a township of it. He picked up the bandage from the floor with a stick and consigned it to the flames, and found a fair white cloth to bind the arm with.
"Now, do you scrub yon greasy spot where the bandage lay, and get that firkin downstream of here. Don't bring it back either. And after this, conceal thy wounds from Mr. Meadows. Come to me or to Mr. Barrowbridge. See you don't go near the laboratory until you get that bandage as dirty as the one I burnt."
Tears came silently. The heavy creature pressed his hands shyly and turned away.
"Well, hang it," he thought. "Where would we get another mute if she took a poisoning?"
He went round to the great hall and stopped dead at the sight which confronted him. Miss Callow was on the settle where he had left her, but now she sat bolt upright and even a little back-leaning. She had a forced, uncertain smile on her face and was saying,
"How do you do?"
in the tones of one who has made the same observation at least 3 times with no response, and advancing on her wordlessly, a step at a time, with stops between, was Meadows. As a child, Lance had learned that if one street urchin wishes to disconcert another, he need only stare fixedly at the other's forehead, close over the eyes. The victim will try to meet the other's gaze, and cannot. Nothing makes a man appear more mad than a fixed and unreachable stare like that. He saw here that one need not be an urchin to be disconcerted. Miss Callow was more than disconcerted. If she didn't bolt, she would faint. And now,
"Meadows!"
Meadows glanced at him, and the spell was broken.
"Mr. Meadows, Miss Callow,"
Meadows said.
"That face!"
"It impresses me too,"
said Lance quickly, and took Miss Callow's hand.
"We'd best be getting back to Minden."
As she turned eagerly and gratefully to him, Lance understood what had happened. Meadows, irresistibly, off on his Hippocratic urge, had seen the sprinkle of acne across her brow and down the sides of her nose. Single-minded as he was, he must have concluded that this was a patient, and with dedication such as his, a patient is not a person, but a disease. The chances are good that there had been nothing in his mind at all as he crossed the room toward her except lists of ingredients from his impulsive apothecary. None of this was explicable, so Lance said.
"He's interested in you,"
in a quick whisper, and to the anxious Meadows.
"I'll bring her back soon."
And he whisked her out.
"He frightened me,"
she said candidly when they reached the footbridge.
"Only mysteries, fair scientist," said Lance. It was one of Barrowbridge's saws. "He was interested in you, that is all."
"My," she breathed, "what has come over me these days?"
"Nothing yet," he said, but silently to himself.
He felt miserable. He liked plans which worked out.
"We needn't walk so fast," she said a little breathlessly. "Sir Gregory has gone to London with Miss Elaine, and the cook can take care of the other two."
"I must hurry back. He'll need me. He's doing a great work."
Oh dear, what is it?"
"I cannot tell you until it's finished."
"Oh, of course. I'm sorry. You needn't walk all the way to Minden, Captain, nor if it'll obstruct your work."
"Why, I couldn't think of—"
"Please, I shall be safe. It's broad daylight, and with Sir Gregory not there, well, you needn't. Really."
He knew she didn't mean a word of it, but he stopped and doffed his hat.
"Very well, then. It's most thoughtful of you, Miss Callow."
"Goodbye,"
she said wistfully, and, "Tomorrow?" He had a horde intuit that if he denied her, she would follow him home.
"Tomorrow,"
he said, the breathy, stringed instrument way. He watched her go, heartily wishing she would fall into the brook, wishing he were back in London. London. Whatever was going on in London by this time? He must ride out for the post. He strolled slowly back to the house. A hangdog Meadows awaited him.
"My sale, man, I was such a bore. No, don't be decent about it. I was. I don't know what's gotten into me."
"You've been working too hard."
"Perhaps I ought to go back to London and—"
"I haven't been helping you enough, that is all."
"Oh, you have. I shouldn't be able to do anything without your ideas and your confidence in me."
"What confidence?"
He couldn't help it. It just slipped out.
Said Meadows. "You're pulling my leg, I say. That Miss Fallow—"
"Callow. She isn't fallow,"
corrected Lance with deep conviction.
"I just couldn't do anything else. There's eruption on her. My, what I wouldn't give to have them here to work on. What is it?"
"Twonk's disease,"
said Lance soberly.
"Oh dear, well, the poor thing. I'd like to help."
"Perhaps she is better off the way she is."
"You can't mean that."
"I don't suppose I can."
He turned to the door.
"I have to go."
He went inside.
"Brave chap,"
murmured Meadows. He went to the lab to see if he could find, in Paracelsus, a reference to Twonk's disease. Upstairs, Lance flung himself into Barrowbridge's great chair. The barrister looked at him questioningly, and Lance simply shook his head.
"I wish I could help, lad."
"That's what Meadows said."
"He didn't."
"He did. I told him she had Twonk's disease, and off he scurried to invent some foul concoction to cure her."
"I've got it."
"Good heavens, sir."
Lance sat back. Barrowbridge's sudden exclamation had bent him like a bow.
"A scandal you wanted, and a scandal you shall get."
Barrowbridge began to laugh, and then he began to talk. It was warm and dark. The great hall was dimly lit by two candles, a lanthorn and the fireplace, and some stray light from the laboratory, where the interminable simmering and kilning process, regardless of the hour, took place. Lance led Miss Callow in, then paused and listened. All was quiet. He had extracted her from Minden without being seen, in the best romantic tradition. A pebble at her window, a whispered word. They had hardly spoken to one another, except for the heavy pulse that beat against him as he held her before him on the horse. He took her hand and led her to the central bedroom, taking one of the candles as they passed the fireplace. Inside the room, he put down the candle and took her by the shoulders.
"Don't be afraid,"
he whispered. She tried to speak, and apparently she could not. She shook her head.
"You get ready,"
he said, and made a gesture. "Don't leave me alone."
"You won't be alone for long."
He slipped back into the hall, back through the kitchen and up the stairs.
"That quickly?"
Vera Bridge whispered. Lance snapped his fingers to show how quickly. Barrowbridge got comfortable by his gimlet hole.
"You made no promises, nothing specific,"
he ascertained. "Nothing. I was completely misunderstood."
Lance said this with satisfaction. There came a stirring.
"Look."
Lance dived across the bed and took over the gimlet hole. He saw Meadows stop in the light, look to the right, look to the left, and then approach the bedroom. Bearing in both hands before him, like a crown on a cushion, a capacious earthen bowl, he went in. Lance got a confused glance of rapidly moving figures, and then Barrowbridge's hard old shoulder shunted him aside. There came a short, piercing shriek and a reiterated, "No! No! No!" and Meadows' irritated squeak.
"Hell still, Dashiell Hilton! I won't hurt you!"
"Once around and twice around,"
murmured Barrowbridge. Lance saw the third round and the fourth. Miss Callow, revealing an astonishingly hairy body covered with great gobbets of yellow-green grease, shot past the bedroom door with Meadows in hot pursuit, ladling further gobbets of his evil ointment at her, and shrilling at her to hold fast. At last she slipped and fell, and Meadows, turning sharply to follow her, slipped also, and inverted his receptacle over both of them. Miss Callow scuttled under the bedstead and out the other side, through the bedroom door, down the great hall, and out into the night, as fast as her sturdy legs could carry her. Meadows staggered to the bedroom door and hung there, panting and dripping. A perfectly monstrous smell rose up and smote them. Lance coughed and stuffed a corner of his handkerchief into the hold. The smell began to penetrate the walls.
"My God, I had never thought of that."
"Why did he have to use so much?"
"You know, Meadows, if a little is good, a lot is wonderful."
"Well, this is not wonderful,"
choked Barrowbridge.
"I'm sorry, sir. I have to get out."
"Why not stay here and be a sage and let me go out?"
"I'm sorry, sir,"
said Lance and stumbled to the door. Barrowbridge lay back and grinned wryly and began to use the mechanisms he had learned for controlling pain and despair. They worked quite well on this minor thing. Of Miss Callow there was no sign. Lance kept his distance and called from the other end of the hall.
"The devil, Meadows! You didn't have to bathe her in the stuff."
"She wouldn't stay still,"
said Meadows. He was still breathing hard.
"Didn't you want to hear those nasty things?"
"She may not have understood the exact nature of the treatment. Didn't you explain it all?"
"I thought you said you'd do that."
"I said I'd get her ready. I'm sorry, Meadows. We've got to clean this mess up. Though short of burning down the house, I'm not sure how we're going to..."
"It isn't so bad,"
said Meadows judiciously.
"I've had really bad smells going, I remember."
"This is really quite bad enough, Meadows. Come."
Together they stripped the room, taking the bed apart, the carpet, the hangings, the chairs, the table. The evil decoction was splashed high on the walls, on the dresser mirror. Everything went. They dragged it all outside and piled it to be burned on the morrow, when a fire would attract less attention. Lance set Meadows to smearing the walls and floors with soft soap, preparatory to being scrubbed down by Johnson in the morning, and disgustedly went to bed in the carriage house, curled up on the cushions of the trap. It had not amused him, it had not pleased him, it had only been a lot of disgusting work. "But worth it," he thought wryly, wearily.
"Whatever stories she tells."
Mid-morning, and the sound of wheels came.
"I say, Courtney, there's a..."
I see it, Meadows. Clear out, will you? I shall handle this.
Who is that chap from up the path? Sir Gregory Eustace, isn't it?
It is, and there's about to be the devil to pay.
But it was my...
Damn it, this is bad enough without you cluttering this up. Out of sight now. Jump.
He barked this in the tones a bull-voiced younger Barabridge used to use on his terrified office boy. Meadows muttered,
I say,
but faintly, and jumped. Sir Gregory picked his way across the bowling green. He was wearing light brown velvets with white piping and a powdered white wig under his brown tricorn. He looked out of place, both for the place and the time of day. He seemed more than ever like an owl, soft and silent, a little ludicrous, unquestionably carnivorous.
Good morning, Sir Gregory.
Ah, Courtney.
His voice was flat, uninflected. He always spoke in short bursts of syllables, rapidly, with long spaces between. Unquestionably, he did not hoot.
Unpleasant business. Nice day. Too bad.
Too bad,
said Lance, utilizing still another of his mentor's techniques.
Unforgivable. All over London. 9-day wonder. Girl's a fool. Want you to know full extent of the damage. Never heard of such nonsense.
Lance was silent this time. He shrugged humbly.
Got her out here. Carriage. Face to face. What? Whole story. Only right.
As you say, sir.
Deuced humiliating.
Yes, sir, it is, and I couldn't be more sorry,
said Lance in tones which brought sincerity upgushing from his very shoe-tops. Sir Gregory raised his hand and made a slight gesture. He was apparently being watched from the carriage, because the door opened instantly, and the passenger alighted, and with head bowed, with reluctant feet, with shame tears half-dried and blushing cheeks, Elaine Eustace crossed the bowling green.
Elaine Eustace?
Lance stepped back a pace to lay his hands on the wooden balustrade behind him. Something solid, something real. Numbly he waited. Frozen, her father waited. She came and stood before them, her hands behind her, and hid her face in her ruffled collar.
Tell him, Elaine, everything.
The imprisoning lashes raised far enough to release a swift, screened search for Lance's face and dropped again. She said in a soprano whisper,
"Aye."
And then even that faint sound failed her, and she stood crying silently.
"Come, girl."
Her mouth opened and closed. Nothing else about her moved but her slow tears. Sir Gregory made an extremely small but acutely impatient gesture. Lance managed to get his eyes off the girl and meet the frosted owl's eyes. Sir Gregory moved his head sharply, and Lance followed the gesture, and the baronet a few yards away. The girl remained standing precisely where she was, facing the nothingness where the men were not, just as helpless, just as crushed.
"Damn it,"
said the baronet with wet little lips.
"Heavy father. Not my style, don't you know? Ashley, what? Can't stand this, but..."
He wet his lips again, and Lance thought after a time that he had no more to say. It took him so long. But he continued.
"But, right's right, what? Can't have it, agree?"
He flicked an unhappy glance at the girl.
"Make amends. Put it right. Want to have a shot? I can't. I'll wait."
Very carefully, Lance phrased his question.
"Exactly what do you want me to do, sir?"
"Get the story. All of it."
Suddenly the owl countenance looked downdrawn and miserable.
"No mother, you know. Dashed nuisance. Go on, go on. Don't take any nonsense. What?"
"I'll try, sir."
Sir Gregory turned away and turned back.
"I say, Courtney."
"Yes, sir."
"No need to be harsh. What? Sensitive girls, you never know."
Made an abrupt, disgusted sound and strode back up to the carriage as fast as his neat little legs could carry him. Then he returned to the girl. What prompted him to do so he did not know, but he reached out and took her hand. He led her away from the house to the grove of willows and poplars which grew by the stream, and, as if she were made of blown glass, helped her onto the wide swing which hung over the bank. She was submissive, almost inert, but once he had her ensconced and had slipped to the seat beside her, she gave a funny little girl wriggle and hunkered down to a more comfortable inch. Then she was still again, watching with her nearly closed eyes, the hands on her lap, which lay strangely, not folded, but one upon the other, with palms up. She had stopped crying. One of her curls fell forward off her shoulder and swung to her cheek, where it clung. Lance said softly, "Your father wants you to tell me something. Tell me whatever you like." She said nothing. "Perhaps you'd rather not tell me," Lance said, rather stupidly, he thought. "But if you don't, I'll have to know what to say to Sir Gregory." Still she said nothing, and made no move. But by some extra sense he knew there was a change. She was no longer just sitting. She was waiting. Impulsively, recalling more with his fingers than with his mind how it had been to take hold of her hand, he said, "Would you like to hold my hand while you tell me?" She said, not moving her head, and barely her mouth,
"Dark and see."
"I think it would be all right."
"Not if I reached for your hand."
"Well, then." And he took her hand. She then raised her lashes and looked at him, with her eyes wide open. He all but gasped. He had never seen her eyes before. He had hardly seen her at all before. The thing lasted perhaps a tenth of a second, and perhaps its effect on him was neither deep nor important, but he knew it was permanent. After that bright blaze, her eyes hid away again, and she gave her gaze back to the hand he had left in her lap.
"Now, can you tell me what this is about?"
"I don't know. I want to."
"Then do."
"I want to tell you all of it."
Her voice was steady but almost inaudible, and pitched surprisingly low for a child, if she was a child. He tried very hard to imagine how this must be for her, an unaccustomed exercise for him.
"But there's a part I can't say,"
she whispered. He recalled how Berrabridge used to shock the truth out of reluctant clients, and tried a very gentle version of this all the same.
"What's the part that you can't say? Say it."
"I love you."
She laughed then, perhaps 4 pure, clear syllables before the tears returned most unfairly, without warning, so that she choked and had to cough. He had no clean handkerchief to offer, and for that made a solemn vow. She tried awkwardly to reach one which peeped out of her puffed left sleeve with her free left hand. He released the hand he held, but she would not remove it, so he reached over and plucked out the handkerchief and handed it to her.
"Oh, dear, I'm just awful,"
she said miserably, and in the same breath, without pause, and with nothing but joy, said,
"There, I said it, didn't I?"
"I'm very pleased you said it. Is that what your father wanted you to tell me?"
"I don't think so. I have to tell you what I did yesterday."
There followed a continuous rush of words, so rapid and confusing that at first Lance was totally lost, and his impulse was to stop her and make her start over. But then he began picking up things from context, until abruptly the whole picture fell into place.
"Bobby, that's my sister, thought of the armor," was the way she began. "And that made me hurt because it was silly, but it was a very beautiful and right thing to think about you, and I should have thought of it. I hated her because she did it instead. Bella, that's my other sister, always saw you coming up the path, riding or walking. Every time you came, early, late, Bobby saw you first, and that hurt me inside too, because I was the one who should have seen you coming every time. If I really love you, I'd know
when you were coming, and I'd hate to think I didn't."
The blaze of eyes came and was gone so quickly that he almost missed it.
"I hurt, and that was silly, because they're just children and don't know how to love or anything like that. And then I heard about Miss Callow. Miss Callow, she had you to herself all the time, almost every single day, for hours and hours. But I thought about that, and it stopped hurting quite so much, because who could love Miss Callow? And besides, I suddenly thought you were with Miss Callow, so you would talk and talk about me. Please, don't say if you did or didn't. I don't want to know."
She swung a foot, pointed the toe, and swung it again, failing to reach the turf.
"Swing us, please."
"I beg your..." "Oh."
He set them swinging gently. Her left hand still slept curled in her lap like a pink shell, and still she spoke down into it, gazed down into it, as if filling it carefully with the little seeds of her words.
"So I heard about Miss Barbie, and about Bella, and about Callow, excuse me, Miss Callow, and then Da took me to London, and I thought of something so wonderful I almost couldn't sleep the whole night before, and I did it. I never thought anybody would be upset. I told everybody, just everybody I could, I was to be married to you."
This time it was not a blaze, a flash. It was a long, careful, wide-eyed examination of his face, his mouth, the tilt of his head, up to his hair, down to his chin, and around its point. During it he sat steady and watched her eyes, doing this careful thing, knowing that the slightest misconstrued quiver of a cheek, shift of a lip, tension of a jaw and temple, might wound her beyond bearing. He was not aware of trying not to wound her. He simply knew he could. He did not. When she dropped her gaze, it was like putting down a weight. Her very shoulders slumped with relief.
"Da began to hear about it at tea time, and oh, dozens of times after that. People just flocked about us. Some of them knew you. Da was kind while they were doing it. He told them they must have mixed me up with someone else, or he joked and said, 'Yes, I'm to marry the Princess of Wales.' He never once said I was a little liar. And a thief, too."
"A thief?"
"The ring. Oh, Da said I must tell you specifically about the ring and show it to you."
Deftly she unbuttoned a small, tight pocket in her waistband and extracted a cushion of silk and handed it to him. Being as careful as she had been not to remove the contact of their hands, he worked it open and found himself staring, thunderstruck, at a curiously wrought ring, the only one carrying both silver and gold that he had ever instinctively liked. It bore a diamond cut like a teardrop, an immense thing weighing about 7 carats or better.
"It was Mother's ring," she explained. "I took it the night before we left, and then, wherever we went, whenever I could be out of sight for a second, I told people."
"That we were engaged, you and I? And with this?"
She nodded briefly and tumbled along with her narrative, and a good thing, too. Lance didn't know whether to laugh or drop his jaw or what to say. He sat listening and watching the hard beams of the jewel as the swing shifted about amongst the leaf shadows and the freckled sun between.
Oh, God, how they must have talked in London! And Barrowbridge had been looking for a scandal, had he? Dear God!
"Da was kind when the people were talking to us, but all the way back in the carriage, all the way back, he told me how wicked it was for me to do that, to be a liar and a thief, and was only the first small part of it, he said. He said I might have done you some terrible damage. He said it wasn't fair to a young man to tell the world he had such a stone. He said you'd have every right to be angry. And what's a Jack Tictation?"
"A what?"
"Oh, you frightened me. Didn't I say it right?"
"Who told you about Jack Tictation?"
"I don't know. Somebody.
everybody. They're all talking about it in London. Somebody got one, she said, uncaring. They said you could get one against me. About 4 different people said that to me, to tease me. What is it?
A tease, he said, and smiled it away. So, somebody got one, he exulted.
The exultation was sufficient to handle this and any other situation which might present itself this wonderful day.
Is that all you were to tell me?
Yes.
Am I angry?
You don't look angry, she said hopefully.
Come along to your father and we'll see how angry I am.
She said, as if she was still in the throes of her narrative, as if she had not claimed to have finished it.
And he said the worst thing I might have done would be to spoil it for you if you were engaged to someone else.
At that he laughed.
I'm not, however. Would you be sorry if you'd done that one thing, though?
I keep giving you things to hate me for, she said, appalled.
Then,
no, I wouldn't. I'd be glad, but don't tell Da I said that.
He laughed again and slipped off the swing, held out both his hands. She took them and skipped down, and for a perilous moment held tight and stood close. He thought he was going to kiss her, and he thought she was going to cry.
Don't cry, he whispered to her. If you cry, you are a child.
I'm almost 15, she said coolly,
and then she did cry. 2 little tears on each side. She scrubbed angrily at them with her handkerchief.
I'm just being sentimental,
she pouted, for reasons of her mysterious own. He took her hand, and because he knew she wanted to be stately and chastened, he perversely ran with her up to the carriage, so that she arrived high-coloured and laughing and begging him to stop. He saw the delight in the baronet's face, and swiftly the overlay of the disciplinarian.
"Your daughter, sir," he said in a courtly fashion, handing her up.
"Have you told Captain Courtney everything?"
"Yes, Dar."
"I accept responsibility, Captain. If I may make amends, letters to anyone, restitution, whatever is needed. What?"
"You may grant a great favour,
sir." "Granted. Quite. What is it?"
"But it would be granted to Miss Elaine, sir, and not to me."
"Ask."
"Punish her no more, sir. She now understands, and I am quite unharmed."
Down climbed the baronet, and brought his again unreadable little face close to Lance's. "That favour's granted. Neither to you, but to me. Well, you know it." And Lance knew he had played this right. "Like a Boroughbridge," he said.
"So much the better, sir. It will make us all 3 very happy."
"Very deft tongue. Good future to you. Assist any way. Call on me when you need me."
"You are most kind, Sir Gregory."
"Nonsense," said the baronet. He climbed into his carriage and was off. Lance saw the girl's head as it was put shyly out of the carriage and snatched swiftly back. He returned to the house, shaking his head and smiling to himself.
"Meadows! Meadows, I say!"
No answer. He went to the door of the laboratory wing.
"Meadows!"
Something moved in the far corner. Lance went in, laughing.
"You can come out, old chap. It's... oh dear."
He found himself face to face with Hepzibah Callow.